Support for KPLU and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, with a reminder that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Well, I'm here at Tillicum Place Cafe in Belltown in Seattle, and I'm here with KPLU food talker Nancy Leeson. Nancy, what's good here?
Well, I know that everyone seems to love the Dutch babies here, and I've had them, and they're delicious. But the soups and sandwiches I always love. My favorite, the sardine sandwich with a tapenade, arugula, and roasted tomato.
That does sound great, except for the sardine in my case, but I'm going to take your word for it.
More for me, Gabe.
So I meant to ask you, like, what's your ideal lunch date?
My ideal date is being alone, Gabe. So really, why are you even here?
That is a really good question, Nancy. You know, the reason I'm here is because this is Sound Effect. It's the show I host, so you know I figured I'll get in on the beginning of it. But our theme today is going solo, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about dining solo. What do you like about eating by yourself?
I love the fact that I can be one with myself. I think that we spend so much time not only with other people, but being annoyed by other people, by emails and tweets and phone calls and Skyping and things that we have to do and our families. And yeah, do we love them? Of course we do. But really, I don't get enough time by myself, and I really appreciate spending time in one of my favorite places ever, a restaurant.
And do you like this restaurant in particular for this kind of thing? Like, is this a well-suited place for eating solo?
This place is perfect for a lot of reasons. And there's a lot of restaurants in Seattle that are like this. For one, I can watch the kitchen. There's a counter, bar. So this is common these days. You could sit at a bar. People don't think you're abroad trying to get picked up like they used to back in the old days. Now you're just enjoying lunch at a wonderful place, or dinner, or a drink. And there's wonderful window tables here, so you can sit and watch the sidewalk traffic, watch the world go by, and lots of nice little tiny corner tables that work for me. I'm happy to be sitting right where I am in the middle of the room, watching the kitchen, the bar, and the door.
So I kind of like eating by myself too, and I like going to movies by myself sometimes and doing other stuff. And when I tell people that, often the reaction I get is, aww. Like, people think that that's sad or pathetic, and maybe it is in my case, but do you get that ever?
You know, I famously got that once when I was on a vacation alone years ago in Hawaii. I had saved my very last night for the big expensive meal. I didn't have a lot of money, and this was the one blowout meal at Alan Wong's Canoe House. It was the most glorious meal that I remember everything about it to this day, and we're talking, this was over 20 years ago. I was sitting in this beautiful large table beachside, and I had a wonderful waitress who treated me just the way waiters are supposed to treat you when you're dining alone, like any other guest.
That's great. Well, Nancy Leeson, party of one, half of the KPLU Food for Thought duo, thank you so much for helping us get this show up and running today.
You're more than welcome, Gabe. Are you leaving now?
I guess. I'll see you later then, I guess. Okay, bye.
See ya.
We will be having stories of going solo today on KPLU's Sound Effect, so don't go away. I am hungry. Hey, Nancy, I'm just really hungry. Can I just stay for like a... I'll just have soup. Can I just have soup? Like a cup of soup.
Gabe, if you're gonna snivel, you might as well have the full meal deal. Sure, have a seat.
We're going to start off by meeting a man who's a hero to loners everywhere. And he may be responsible for more aggregate hours wasted than anyone pretty much in the history of time. Wes Cherry did not invent the game Solitaire, but he did invent Solitaire for the modern age. In 1988, he was an intern for Microsoft, and Cherry wrote on his own time this code that would become Solitaire for Windows. These days, he does something totally different. He runs his own cidery on Vashon Island with his wife and his son. And I joined him there at his orchard to hear about what it's been like touching so many people in this very specific way and about the life he lives today.
We're next to the orchard here at Dragon's Head Cider. These are some trees that we started planting about 5 years ago.
How many trees are there?
Right now, about 2,200, and we're going to plant another 800 this winter, and I think that'll be plenty.
And would they be tasty if you just picked them off the tree and sunk your teeth into them?
Most of them not. They actually call a lot of them spitters. There's one in particular that really tastes about like a crushed up Tylenol.
But the cider doesn't taste like that, I assume?
No, once the yeast is done with the flavors, it blends and transforms into something really quite lovely.
And how long have you been nursing this dream of having a, forgive me, is it a cidery?
Yes, cidery would be the right term. I thought about opening a winery or something like that starting about 10 years ago after I quit Microsoft.
So this was something that began to take shape while you were toiling away at Microsoft. And of course, that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. Maybe we could go hang out inside for a few minutes and get that story. And then I might prevail on you to let me try a cup of your cider.
Absolutely. Love to.
All right. What were you up to in the late 80s that made you find your way to the Redmond campus?
Working at Microsoft had been a dream since I was a young child. I had computers back when I was 10. And on those computers, I'd write a lot of games because you had to. There was no games available to speak of. And then as I was in college, I got an internship job at Microsoft working on Microsoft Excel.
So that was your gig at that time. You were working on Excel. And how did you sort of get to, you know, hobbying around on this particular project?
Well, Windows was still really in its infancy at the time, and I wanted to learn how to program in Windows. So I picked projects to learn how the API worked and what it took to write a program. Solitaire in particular, there was a Macintosh version of it that I played pretty extensively in college instead of studying for finals. And as I got to Microsoft in the summer, there's very, very little software available for Windows at the time. This was Windows 2.0. So I wrote a version of Solitaire, basically, because I wanted to, waste some time then, too.
So this wasn't even on the job, necessarily?
No, this was all on my own time, yeah. There was actually a company at Microsoft within Microsoft. It was really not really a company, but we called ourselves Bogus Software. And there was a server where people would put up the games that they wrote, and other people would download them and play them.
Got it. So it was a kind of a nerdy society within Microsoft.
Right, exactly.
So this is effectively like a worksheet that you did, the equivalent of just this little exercise that you did that wound up having a life longer than you must have ever imagined.
Oh, absolutely. I wrote it for myself, you know, and it just happened that some program manager in Windows decided to put it into the Windows 3.0 package, and it kind of exploded.
Let's talk about some of the aesthetic choices that you made in making the game. So first of all, it's a pretty standard game in terms of the rules and stuff like that, right? It's your classic solitaire setup, right? So what were some of the choices that you were able to make in terms of the look of it and the functionality?
Well, we had a lot of fun with the art of the card backgrounds. A lot of those card backs were inspired by, I don't know, things I was doing in my life at the time. The beach scene was a beach called San Felipe down in Mexico that we'd go to very regularly in spring break. The one with the card crawling up and down the sleeve of the dealer is a reference to the Grateful Dead. And back then, I was listening to a lot of Grateful Dead.
When did you realize that this was going to be something pretty big?
Well, it really is only after Windows shipped. And I would get, people just like, you know, had people bow down in front of me. And I was like, geez.
Wait, where did that happen?
Somebody, you know, introduced me as the author of Solitaire. And the guy got down on his knees and bowed to me.
Were you pals with the Minesweeper guy and the Hearts guy?
Yes, I knew them.
Oh, that was a joke, but that's a real, yeah. Real yes.
Well, yeah, the Minesweeper guy, he was also part of Bogus Software.
So how many millions did writing the arguably most popular game of that decade make you?
0.00008, I think. I think I got that right. At one point in an interview, I said, if I only got a penny a copy, wouldn't it have been great? And, you know, it would have been a tremendous amount of money. So over the years, I have received 8 cents.
Oh, like people will send you a penny?
Exactly.
Wow, congratulations. But no royalties?
No royalties. And that was made clear. I did it for fun.
And what, then you had a sort of a normal job at Microsoft for some years, right?
Yeah. I was a developer on Excel for about 10 years.
Did the reputation of having been the solitaire inventor follow you around at the company?
You know, people knew of me. I knew Bill Gates knew about me, right, for example. He actually complained that it was too hard to win solitaire. Maybe I should have just checked if the username was Bill Gates and given him a good deal of the hands.
Have you stopped to think between Excel and solitaire, like how much time your work has spent with so many individuals? I mean, years of people's lives, probably. Do you feel bad about that?
No, I think wasting time and slacking off is one of the highest things that a human can do. I mean, like, we're here to have fun, so we should be having fun.
So what did you do after Microsoft?
After Microsoft, I got a little tired of doing things in the virtual world. I really wanted to do something that had physicality. And my wife sat us down and said, we need to have a 5-year plan. And so we made a list of what we wanted in our life. And then once we were looking for property on Vashon, I saw apple trees growing everywhere here. And so my dream of having a winery or a cidery kind of all came together in this heady 5-month window, not 5 years, but in 5 months.
So what's your life like here now?
When I come home at the end of the day, I'm exhausted. I came home from Microsoft, I was exhausted, but it's a totally different kind of exhausted. Part of it is there's like a physicality. You can look at something and see, you know, an orchard that's well tended. With software, you know, you've got lines of code and you can take an internal happiness at how beautifully it fits together, but it just never felt like there was a thing there.
So could I hit you up to taste a little cider?
Yeah, let's do it.
Cheers, or whatever you say. Delicious. Well, Wes Cherry, founder of Dragon's Head Cidery here on Vashon Island, and inventor of Solitaire for Windows back in 1988. Thank you so much for having me over and for sharing some of your delicious beverages with me.
Thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we are talking about going solo. Back in October, Sarah Brandeber thought, I sure would like to see some larch trees. Larch are the rare coniferous trees that actually change colors in the fall. They turn gold and their needles fall off. They're really gorgeous. And so she set out on a hike to Lake Ingalls near Cle Elum, where there were lots of these trees. Sarah's a pretty experienced hiker, and she brought a friend, so going solo was not part of the plan. But as Sarah tells us, plans change.
It was a 2.5-hour drive just to get to the trailhead, and then it was a 9-mile hike, so it was going to be kind of an all-day thing. And my friend Cherie said that she would be willing to do it with me. I was really pumped and just kind of raring to go once we got there. And we start up on the trail, and we're less than maybe 0.5 mile in, and I could kind of sense behind me that Cherie was not enjoying herself. And then she stopped me and said, Sarah, I can't keep going. She said that she had done her first CrossFit session the night before and her legs were shaking. We immediately started this back and forth where she was like, I'm gonna be mad at you if you don't do this hike. I really want you to bring back pictures of the lake that we were supposed to hike to. I have my hammock, I have my book and my journal. So I told her I would only go all the way if I was making a really good pace. It was gorgeous. It was easily one of the most beautiful hikes I've ever done. And the last part of the hike, it's like a rock scramble. It's not even really a trail anymore. And made my way to the lake, and I had the lake to myself, and I was just kind of eating my sandwich. And as soon as I finished, I headed back down because I was in a hurry to get back to Cherie. And it wasn't until 45 minutes, an hour later, where I really started to realize that I had gone the totally wrong way. I remembered that the whole hike up, there had been a creek flowing down. And I could hear the creek from where I was standing. And so I went to that and I said, if nothing else, the water is all flowing in one direction, down and out, so I can follow that. So that was kind of my decision at that point. Then it hit 2, 3, 4, 5 p.m. and I'm still in thick underbrush with no sign that I'm nearing the bottom of the mountain. I asked God for a sign, and shortly after I said that prayer, I looked several yards ahead and saw something bright blue and shiny up in the bushes. And I got really excited because I thought it might be a piece of equipment or a backpack, meaning that another hiker or someone was nearby. So I sprinted up to it, and as soon as I came upon it, I realized that it was a really big, still almost fully inflated happy birthday balloon, like one you would get from the grocery store in that gift section. And I had not seen a single other piece of garbage on this entire trail. So the fact that there's this still fully inflated happy birthday balloon that floated all the way up there was really bizarre. So now I'm kind of hiking along with this balloon. It hit 6 p.m. and I realized it was going to be getting dark soon and I needed to make a choice. I was a little bit nervous about spending the night in the woods. I had a bag of almonds, an apple, a banana, and half of a water bottle left. The temperature was dropping. I knew it was going to hit the low 30s during the night. I was wearing like running tights that were lightly fleece lined, and then a tank top and a long sleeve kind of dry fit material shirt and a thin down vest. And I had also left a hammock in my backpack and kind of found a spot on the ground under this low-hanging tree and kind of wrapped my hammock around me and pulled myself into the tightest fetal position possible. And I was praying that exhaustion would take over because I knew I had 12 full hours until the sun was going to be up again. So I really just prayed to be so exhausted and sleep away most of those hours. I had my cell phone on me and it only had 30% battery left and I had zero phone service. But I did have a few songs saved on my phone, and one of them is a worship song that's really calming. And so I thought, well, I'll play that on low volume, kind of put it right near my ear to drown out animal noises and, you know, the wind. I woke up, and my phone, by the way, was still playing this song. It didn't die. And I looked at my phone, and it was 5:30 in the morning, so I had slept almost 10 hours. You know, I am completely alone. I have no idea where I am. I haven't seen another person since yesterday, early afternoon. Everyone feels lonely at some point, but this was like a very desperate feeling of isolation. I knew no one could hear me, you know, if I were crying or if I screamed. And so that was a pretty sobering thought. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing and follow the creek. It's got to lead me to the bottom at some point. I'm out of water, starting to feel dehydrated and dizzy. And at this point, I see a rescue helicopter flying overhead. And I saw the guy like kind of hanging half out of the helicopter. I was so tired that I could barely move my arms, but I did my best to like wave and get their attention. And I had been hiking with my hammock over my backpack because it was bright turquoise and yellow. So I knew they would see it, if anything, but they passed right over me. And that was just crushing. I sat down for a minute on a log and my legs were like screaming. For a minute, I was just like, I don't want to keep going. I'm tired. But then I had a thought of, Sarah, people are looking for you. They don't know if you're alive or if you broke your leg and you're in a ditch somewhere. So you need to kind of suck it up and keep going. So I kept hiking and hiking, and I saw what looked like a road up ahead, but I didn't let myself get too excited again because I had several massive fallen logs had appeared to be roads. But as I got closer, I saw the outline of a trail sign and a privy, and I started sprinting. And I hit pavement, and then I saw what was either a massive cabin or a house up on my right, a black lab on the porch. And the dog was jumping up and licking me and barking, and a man opened the door, probably because he was wondering what all the commotion was about, and I just collapsed at that point. I think all I was able to choke out is, I've been lost since yesterday, my family doesn't know where I am or if I'm okay. And I was crying so hard that I'm surprised they could understand me. And the man said, well, if you've been lost since yesterday, there's probably some folks out looking for you, so I'm gonna call the sheriff. So then the sheriff came to the house, and he walked in and he would just looked like someone who could keep you safe. He was like 6'5" and built and was kind of just like super serious. He's like, do you want to see on a map what you did? And he showed me where I had turned the wrong way and ended up on the total backside of this mountain. He said, you could have been hiking 4 days. That is 8,000 acres of wilderness. Judging by what you did, you hiked between 35 and 40 miles. Then we went out to his truck, and Taylor Swift was blasting on his radio. And he was like, you can change it if you want to. And I was like, nope, this is perfect. And it just made me laugh. I mean, this huge, tough guy blasting Taylor Swift. And I think I just needed to laugh at that point. I felt the lowest of lows when I was isolated and alone and not sure that I was going to get out of there or see my family or friends again. Because I allowed myself to go there emotionally. Then when I was reunited with people, I felt the greatest joy and ecstasy I've ever felt. I think that's it.
Sarah Brandeber is a student at Seattle Pacific University. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. We are going solo today, and I'm calling this next story, Why Does Roger Valdez Feel Lonely?
So this is your place?
Yeah, it's a pretty small lot that they tucked this building into, and you can tell it's pretty consistent with the Apodment brand.
Valdez is a lot of things. He's an advocate for density, for one. A lot of people would call him a lobbyist for developers, and in fact, a lot of people would have less kind words for him. He's a little polarizing. But one thing about Roger, he walks his talk. He lives in an Apodment brand micro-housing unit in Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood.
Just don't have any particular use for.
I love having this up here because it's kind of nice to have a little overflow.
The tour did not take long. The whole thing is less than 300 square feet, if you include the loft. But to be honest, Valdez hardly uses the loft. He doesn't seem to need that extra space, I guess.
I get my old view back. If I lost it completely to a solid blank wall, I'd be pretty upset. And right over there is another.
The ceilings are high, which makes it feel bigger than it is. It's a little like a studio apartment tipped on its end. And all this goes along with Valdez's whole worldview. Fewer detached houses, smaller carbon footprint. But it might be surprising that a guy who thinks we should all be living shoulder to shoulder also luxuriates in being lonely. That's actually part of the whole story of how he got here. Valdez lived with his wife for years in a normal-sized apartment. But they split up, and it seemed like a good time for him to move into the kind of housing he advocates for. In a micro-apartment, you can't escape your own aloneness.
This was a great opportunity moving here to be able to, like, say, okay, I'm going to do it myself. And it was sort of like, yeah, I live in one. Because when people criticized it and said, you know, these are too small, they're inhuman, they're cages or whatever, I could say, I love mine. And so it was both, I think, a statement about being prepared to live in a place that I thought should be built for people, but also to not take up so much space. because I live alone, I have a tremendous sense of it feels like very roomy to me. And I feel like because I am the kind of person that spends more time out of my house or my apartment, that I don't need a lot of extra space for lounging around or storing things or whatever. I've never been the kind of person that's had, you know, like a lot of furniture or whatever. I've never had, you know, a lot of things. And whenever I think about, like, what do I need, you know, it's very, very minimal. Like, if I really came down to it, like, what do you absolutely need? If that place was burning down, what would you take, you know?
Do you always think you would have been comfortable in a place like this? Or did something change in your life that made this a better fit?
You know, my marriage ended at the end of 2013, and my wife and I used to live about probably 2.5-3 blocks away from here. When I moved in with her, it was, you know, I didn't bring a lot of my own stuff. So when I left and I saw this going up, it was brand new. I was like, this is perfect because I can literally walk down the street. I'm still in the same neighborhood and I'm good. You know, it's not going to change anything. I'm not having to commute different. It's this, all the same stuff. When a relationship breaks up, oftentimes when it's finally over and you move out, you kind of get that excitement of like, wow, I'm going to get to into a new place and I get to do whatever I want. Moving in here, it was really fun. It was great. I felt excited about it. This is probably the first time I've really lived alone for almost 20 years or something like that. I think loneliness is something that I've, for the first time, kind of encountered in the last couple of years. Living alone, one doesn't have that obligation to be somewhere or a feeling of someone's coming back or the expectation of, you know, well, I'll get a chance to talk to this person at the end of the day. What I found is I was sort of shocked, like, oh, that's what that is.
How is feeling lonely different from being alone?
There's a French writer named Roland Barthes. He has a book called Lover's Discourse, and he talks about, you know, you're in love when you're waiting. And I think loneliness is like that. It's like a feeling of you're waiting for something to happen when you're in love. You're waiting for that person to show up and they're 15 minutes late and you're the one waiting and you feel vulnerable and you feel kind of hanging out there. But loneliness is having that same feeling, but nobody's coming. There's nobody on their way.
Do you think that loneliness and aloneness get a bad rap?
Yeah, I do. I mean, in order to really enjoy being with someone, you have to be able to be alone with them. And that's something that I realized in the last couple of years too, is that being alone together is a real litmus test for me, I think, in the end of what you need to be able to do, not just with another individual, but in the community.
It seems like there might be a contradiction between valuing aloneness and even loneliness and also advocating living very close together with a lot of other people.
It is a peculiar thing, and I've struggled with that a lot. There's a line in Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities. He talks about it, in every city, behind every, you know, window is a beating heart and a story and a drama going on. And I think that being in a city is a very lonely experience in some ways because there's so many people, but they're all strangers. And so the multiplicity and the number of people that are strange and that you don't know can, I think, add to a sense of loneliness. But on the other hand, I think the advantages of that are that it creates both an opportunity to see and be seen. You know, you become part of something anonymously in a way that I think is very comforting for people, to be part of a bigger throbbing kind of entity. Is very comforting.
Is there some ritual that you have or something that you just like to do to go and feel part of a community?
I mean, I have my favorite coffee shops, and I think if you went, I'm one of those people that's a regular. If I go to Joe Bar, which is up the street from here, they're like, hey, Roger, how's it going? You want the regular? Or, you know, there's a real strong sense of community that comes from just being kind of just hanging out in public places and getting to know the people that work there and them getting to know you. And it's not a real deep thing, but I think that you do get a sense that, well, at least somebody knows that I'm alive and that I exist.
And they might notice, like, if you took a spill on that ladder.
I don't know about that, but I think there's something really important in the idea that in a city you can be seen, but still be anonymous or alone. It's how we are. We hate being alone, but there's also a part of us that hates being, kind of put on the spot. So I think cities have a unique opportunity to do both of those things.
I guess this is kind of an obvious question, but you don't strike me as a person for whom aloneness is part of your public persona, right? Like, you are out there in the media, you have a political career, you are an advocate, a communicator, you are mixing it up in public all the time. It might surprise some people to know that you're a person who values being alone and even values loneliness.
I think many people who have public lives, in the end, you'd be surprised how much you'd find them kind of just sitting by themselves in an airport or something, kind of doing a crossword puzzle. And you think, where's all the people that should be around them? And I've always been a person that enjoys being with other people, but I also like to be alone.
Well, Roger Valdez is an advocate, a lobbyist, a communicator, and a dweller in a micro-housing unit. That's where we talked, here in the loft of his unit in Capitol Hill. Thank you so much for inviting me in and for sharing your story.
Oh, thank you for coming.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and today we're telling stories about going solo. If a relationship or a job goes bad, you might need a way to extricate yourself and get by on your own for a while. But what if you don't have your own resources? This, of course, is something you can plan for. It's just that none of us ever thinks about it when we're young and assuming everything's going to go just exactly as planned. Seattle writer Paulette Perhatch has this story of why it's so important to save up that extra escape cash, or as she puts it, a bleep-off fund. And yes, this story does contain many, many bleeps.
You're telling your own story. You graduated college and you're a grown-ass woman now. Tina Fey is your hero, Beyonce your preacher. You know how to take care of you. You've learned self-defense. If any man ever hit you, you'd rip his eyes out. You've seen Mad Men, and if anyone ever sexually harassed you at work, you tell him to right off, throw your coffee in his face, and wave two middle fingers as you marched out the door. You get your first internship. You get your first credit card. You get to walk into Nordstrom, where your mom would never take you, and congratulate yourself with one fabulous black leather skirt and the heels to match. Your car? It's the car of a college student. You get a lease, graduate from the rusted Civic to last year's Accord. You get your first student loan bill, and look at all those numbers. Your life turns into a stock photo tagged young professionals. You and your new work friends hang out at the bar across the street from the office. The cocktails cost twice as much as you paid when you still measured time by semesters and nights by cans of PBR. The college boyfriend gets serious. You move into his place, spruce it up by buying your first coffee table together. IKEA lets you put half on your newest credit card. You pay minimum payments, then max out your cards again, buying 2 days' worth of groceries and filling your gas tank halfway. Your bank app upgrades to a new feature that combines all your balances, the shiny Nordstrom card with the Visa and the Chase Freedom you were only supposed to use for emergencies, and tells you that somehow you owe people $7,000. Your boyfriend offers to cover rent for a while. You get a job a few months later, but you're that many loan payments behind. Your first paycheck feels like a breath of air that gets sucked right out of your lungs. Your new boss, who seems nice, calls you in his office, shows you a picture of his kids. He jokes about his son. Then, as you're laughing, he puts his hand on your arm, gives you a little squeeze. You smile it off. You wait to pay the electric bill while you're gathering up the half you owe, and the lights go out. On your phone, in the dark, you see the email about the $50 late fee. Your boyfriend asks how you could be so stupid. I am not stupid, you say. You would never be with anyone who called you names, but you would never be able to make first, last, and deposit right now either. You say yes to P.F. Chang's with your new coworkers because you want to make friends. Your turkey sandwich sounds boring, and what's one more charge? You buy a halter dress you know you can't afford because it makes you look like the successful young woman you want everyone to think you are. Your boss tells you that you look nice in that dress, asks you to do a spin. Just to get the moment over with, you do. Your boyfriend asks how much you paid for it, says it makes you look chubby. You lock yourself in the bathroom until he bangs on the door so hard you think he must have hurt himself. After he falls asleep, you search Craigslist for places and can't believe how expensive rent's gotten around town. You erase your internet history and go to sleep. A few weeks later, your boss calls a one-on-one in his office, walks in behind you, and stands too close. His breath fogs your neck. His hand crawls up your new dress. You squirm away. He says, "Sorry, I thought..." You know what to do. You're just shocked to find you're not doing it. You are not telling him to f*** off. You are not storming out. All you're doing is math. You have $159 in the bank, and your car payment and your maxed out credit cards, and you'll die before you ask your dad for a loan again, and it all equals one thought. I need this job. "It's okay," you hear your voice saying. "Just forget it." You scurry out of the room, survey the office half full of women, and wonder how many of them have secrets like the one you're about to keep. At the apartment, your best guy friend calls. After you hang up, your boyfriend says you laugh too much with him, that you're flirting with him, probably sleeping with him. You say it's not like that. He yells, you yell, you try to leave, he blocks your way. When you struggle to get by, he grabs your wrist in the exact way they pretended to in self-defense class, and you know to go for the eyes, but you don't know how to go for his eyes. He yanks you back until you fall and crack the coffee table. He seems so sorry, cries even, so that night you lie down in the same bed. You stare up at the dark and try to calculate how long it would take you to save up the cash to move out. Telling yourself that he's sorry, convincing yourself it was an accident, discounting this one time because he didn't hit you exactly, seems much more feasible than finding the money with what you owe every month. The next time you go out as a couple, his arm around your shoulders, you look at all the other girlfriends and imagine finger-sized bruises under their long sleeves. Wait, this story sucks. If it were one of those choose-your-own-adventures, here's where you'd want to flip back, start over, rewrite what happens to you. You graduated college and you're a grown-ass woman now. Tina Fey is your hero, Beyonce your preacher. If any man ever hit you, if anyone ever sexually harassed you, you'd tell him to f*** right off. You want to be, no, you will be the kind of woman who can tell anyone to f*** off if a f*** off is deserved. So naturally, you start a f*** off fund. To build this account, you keep living like you lived as a broke student. Drive the decade-old Civic even after the fender falls off. Buy the thrift store clothes. You waitress on Saturdays, even though you work Monday through Friday. You make do with the garage sale coffee table. It's hard, your loan payments suck, but you make girls' night an at-home thing and do tacos potluck. You save up a f*** off fund of $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, then enough to live half a year without anyone else's help. So when your boss tells you that you look nice, asks you to do a spin, you say, "Is there some way you need my assistance in the professional capacity, or can I go back to my desk now?" When your boyfriend calls you stupid, you say that if he ever says that again, you're out of there, and it's not hard to imagine how you'll accomplish your getaway. When your boss attempts to grope you, you say, "F*** off, you creep." You wave two middle fingers in the air and march over to HR. Whether the system protects you or fails you, you will be able to take care of yourself. When your boyfriend pounds the door, grabs your wrist, you see it as the red flag it is. Leave a post-it note in the night that says, "F*** off, lunatic douche." You stay up in a fancy hotel drinking room service champagne, shopping for apartments, and swiping around on Tinder. Once your f*** off fund is built back up with your new, better job, you pay cash for the most badass black leather skirt you can find, upgrade to the used but nicer convertible you've always wanted, and start saving to go to Thailand with your best friend next summer. Yes, that is a better story. It's a story no one ever told me. It's the kind I'd hope for you.
Paulette Perhatch is a writer in Seattle. It's Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Our theme today is going solo. And it's been said that we come into this world alone and we go out of the world alone. Well, I kind of feel like I want to take whoever said that and just show them some cute cat videos for a while. And yet, there may be some bleak truth to that. But there are some people who work very close to death, who have decided that it doesn't need to be that way. St. Peter's Hospital in Olympia is one of many hospitals with a program known as NODA. That stands for No One Dies Alone. Simply put, they make sure that anyone who wants company in their final hours has it. Sound Effects senior producer Arwin Nix headed down to Olympia to learn about it.
Each day, hundreds of people step through the automatic doors at St. Peter's Hospital in Olympia. Some are there for doctor's appointments or chemo treatments, hoping for a diagnosis, a cure. Some come to spend time with a loved one. I was there for an interview, and I had arrived late. I'd made my way to St. Peter's Hospital Olympia because I wanted to learn more about the NODA program. That stands for No One Dies Alone, and they had set up a time for me to speak with a volunteer. I gave my name to a woman at a desk, and she typed it in and directed me towards some overstuffed chairs. I watched a pink Get Well Soon balloon dance in the gift shop window. I, like many people, have a hard time in hospitals, and I couldn't settle my legs as I waited. After a few minutes, I was greeted and escorted a few yards from the main entrance to the spiritual center, and then into a smaller room within it. The man I was here to meet sat quietly, calmly, and I calmed down too.
Okay, so let me just get your levels to start. So when did you first learn to play guitar?
Charles Kessler has made over 15,000 hospice visits in his life. He plays guitar and piano, and we talked about that as I got his levels on my machine.
I consider myself from California. I moved up here after 25 years in California.
Where in California?
I was in Carmel.
For the last 3 years, he has been one of the more than 100 people that volunteer as part of St. Peter's Hospital's No One Dies Alone program. NODA is a program that links volunteers, strangers, with patients that have 24 or less hours to live. Patients that are going to die in this hospital, without family close enough, or sometimes no family to speak of, to sit with them.
I don't have or need the connection with the personality. That doesn't really interest me at all. It's more like we're all children of God, and the connection is with humanity and the human experience. And I'm moved, you know. I think that all these people have really modeled how to do it for me. And maybe when it's my time, maybe some of that will be a comfort or a teaching for me.
Charles is a tall man, slender, but very unassuming as he sits with his white hair in the corner talking to me. There's an incredible stillness to him.
Well, I'm retired, so I teach yoga and meditation, so I do a lot of practice at home because that's really the source of from teaching.
The stillness, a direct result of those years of practicing and teaching meditation, and it comes in handy for Charles when he volunteers to sit with the near death, with the dying. There's no reading, no talking. These patients are sick, and they're often past the point of conversation.
For the most part at that stage, people are not responsive anymore. They're not talking. And so I think presence is really the main thing that we can offer, just a quiet presence and staying focused and sit with them. And each volunteer probably has their own approach. I would just tell them who I am and what I'm doing, and then mostly have quiet time. I do prayer and meditation and silent mantra just to stay focused. And I will remind them periodically, I'm still here, we're just keeping quiet time. Or if someone comes in, a doctor or a nurse or something like that, after they're done, I'll kind of just recount what happened. And it's just holding a silent presence.
In 2009, a nurse heard about a hospital with a similar program, and she had seen many of her colleagues staying late after their shifts to sit with patients that were alone. So when she brought the idea to St. Peter's, they took it up. The program is now in its seventh year, and it's funded entirely by donation. When a patient is terminal, and the end is approaching, a member of the care team will ask if they would like to be part of the NODA program, if they would like some company. The service isn't only provided to those who don't have anyone at their side, but also as a substitute if a family member sitting with their dying loved one needs to leave for a few minutes or a few hours. The program's not mandatory, and some do say no. Some people want to be alone. But for those who want the company, there are 115 volunteers who work in shifts no longer than 4 hours. Of the many people Charles has sat with during his work as a NODA volunteer, he has been there at the moment of death for 20.
Sometimes I can feel a shift in myself when they're close, like a little adrenaline or something that with no visual cue. For the most part, it just seems like a deep relaxation. When I think they're really close, I'm watching their breath, sometimes timing the space in between breaths because it can be 60 seconds or more before the next, and wondering when is it going to be the last.
We spoke for nearly an hour, and he read me a poem that he wrote, inspired by his work as a volunteer with the NOTA program.
Temple of Love. I'm holding hands with a woman I just met. I only know her name. She's dying. She grips my finger like a baby. A pale pink rosary in her.
In it, he describes this silent dance of the doctors and nurses and volunteers that work to ease the passing of the dying.
A tangle of tubes and monitors, flashing lights, IV drip, receiving the blood of Christ by transfusion. This place has all the charm of an operating room, but for a few hours or days, it's a temple of love, the only thing that matters. A temple for people of all faiths or no faith. I join in the family prayers, Ave Maria, Grazia Plena, and for a few hours, I'm Catholic. A bouquet of sunflowers with huge dark centers, a banana on the shelf reflecting in the window, crosses, rosaries, oxygen, hazardous waste containers, more bananas, slightly overripe. Even the cleaning lady enters in silence and works with reverence. We make eye contact. That's all that is necessary. And for a few hours or days, she's a holy woman. Ave Maria, Grazia Plena. She comes over to hold my hand, tears in her eyes, and heart wide open. No words are necessary in the temple of love.
When I asked Charles if he wanted company in his final hours, he told me he wasn't sure. He's always really loved his alone time.
Sound Effects senior producer Arwin Nix spoke with longtime hospice volunteer Charles Kessler. You can find links for more information about the NOTA program at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwin Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad. And this week, we are so happy to welcome aboard producer Ali Ferguson. We had production help this week from Warren Langford and web help from Dave Nagaris. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. We can visit your earbuds every week for free. Just subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. If that happens to be iTunes, you can take a second while you're there to rate the show and write a quick review. And we'll also take your feedback on Facebook and Twitter or by email at soundeffect@kplu.org. And one more thing, you can find out how you can help save KPLU with your money at kplu.org. We'll be back here next week with stories of being locked in.
This is worse than solitary confinement, because solitary confinement, you can at least move and exercise, move your body about. So in some sense, it's like living hell.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.